when people ask me what town I'm from, you know, where I grew up, I always have to give a region because we moved around a lot.
Yeah.
What about you? Where do you say you're from?
I feel like a Portland, Oregon person. Like, even though I've got a million different accents now, I'm from there, and I left when I was 18, and I grew up in, I can break it down for you. I grew up when I was 15, my family moved to Houston, and I went and then ran, and I didn't like it, and so I found a way to get back out to Portland, and I stayed on sofas and stuff, got out of high school, went to Santa Rosa, California, because there was a ride there. Got down there. That didn't work out. And that's like I was telling that story earlier. I went to stay with my brother in Austin, stayed there and in and around there for a while, for about 4 years. Then I went to Memphis because I'd met Keith Sykes, stayed there for about 4 years, went up to Atlanta for about a year, and then went back to Memphis for a couple years. And then from there, I went to a town called Fairview, and I lived on a farm for about 2 years. Wow. And then I got married and moved to East Nashville about 8 years ago. So the house I'm in now is the longest I've ever lived anywhere.
Wow, that's good. Yeah. So all of that moving around really was as a young adult, though,
yeah.
Not as a kid.
No, yeah, I was pretty sturdy there. We lived in Portland from the time I was born to the time we didn't move. Like I said, it was kind of an upheaval to start all of a sudden being everybody's guest, but it was still my hometown there. My last 2 years in Portland was without my family. But, I think of myself as an Oregonian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like maybe you, I don't want to characterize it myself, but it sounds like maybe you, quote unquote, ran away at an early age.
Yeah, I did. It was, my family had gone broke. It was weird. Like, people would be surprised. People that give a crap about my information are always surprised when I say that when I was really young, we had a lot of bread and my family was all into sports. But when I was 15, that all just imploded and turned into just trying to get by, you know. I don't know what happened. I didn't really get to find out much about all that, but somehow we went broke. And there was a lot of, I think my dad was into drugs, and I knew when I was about 16, something didn't feel right in that house and I didn't want to be in it. And it was in Houston. And I just thought, I don't want to be part of this. It was, it was about 10 years later that I kind of went back to my family and everybody had settled down. But right then it was just some toxic years between my parents and I just got away from them, you know?
That's tough. Now, did your formal education stop at that point?
I made it out of high school barely because, like I said, I didn't have parents in high school, so I didn't go very much. But I went enough to graduate, which surprised everybody. And then that was it, yeah. Then I went down to Santa Rosa with the idea that I'd go to a junior college. But when I got there, I knew in the back of my mind I wasn't going to go to no school. I didn't have no money. That's what I told people I was going to do. So I caught a ride down there and just started the sofa circuit there. And that played out for about a year. I learned to play harmonica while I was there. And then, like I said, my brother was doing construction in Texas and he sent me a plane ticket that got me to Austin. And once I got to Austin, I met this guy, Kent Finley, who runs the Cheatham Street Warehouse. And he thought I had some sort of poetry talent and let me stay at his house and said, you should try to be a poet. You're really good at it. I was playing open mic at his bar. And he'd say, you're really good and you can do this.
Boy, he was really right.
Between him and Keith Sykes, those are the two people those two people telling me I could do it is the reason why I gave it a try.
Wow.
Or, you know, like those two people made me feel like I could make a living out of this. And now it's been 20 some years.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned something about playing at the Cheatham Street Warehouse. That song has just surfaced now on an Oh Boy record
that came out
just this spring.
That's right. I had my very first gig was there, and I lived there. Everything, like Kent Finley took me in and turned me on to Billy Joe Shaver, Kris Kristofferson, John Prine, Jerry Jeff, all the stuff I like. All I knew at the time was Creedence Clearwater and that I liked to rhyme, you know. And he said, listen to this, because my songs sounded like those guys anyway. But Kent got diagnosed with cancer about a long time ago. So we've been really lucky. It was really traumatic when it happened, but it looks like he's a, you know, what do they call it when it's in remission?
In remission,
been in remission for a long time. So, but when it first happened, I was, you know, singing, writing things down about him and the words I was trying to sing this song, like, well, I was trying to say to him, even if you pass away, I'll be able to keep you because you showed me how to do that. I have this song about you that you showed me how to write. Oh. And I wanted to sing that to him before he passed away.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm surprised at hearing is that your formal education ended at high school because your songs are very literate. And you have to be so clever and to write about all of the things that you write about and to be so entertaining, you have an extremely colorful, vivid command of the English language, and to be such a good songwriter, you've got to be. And yet, you don't have anything past high school. You're all self-taught.
Yeah, yeah. I you know what? In fact, I tell my wife my fantasy in life is I would never want to quit music, but if I ever did stop, I'd like to stop for a year and go to college.
I've probably never admitted this publicly, but I know exactly the same feeling.
That sounds so fun to me.
I have a high school education. Yeah. I went to college for 3 days.
Right.
And yet I've never stopped learning, and I love to learn.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the guy that when I go to a museum, my wife gets so frustrated with me because I go to the first exhibit and I read everything.
Yeah.
And I go to the next
exhibit.
That's what
I like to do
everything.
Too.
Yeah,
I do. And I know, I always think when I meet kids that are in college, I'm like, I just crave that. That's like free.
Right.
And it's like, well, you want to know about U.S. history? Go. They'll explain the whole thing. Just
right.
And you can go get beer afterwards. You can get high before you go if you want. Not that you should, but I'm just saying. I've always thought it would be fun to take a year off and go to college and. No, I don't even care if I get a diploma because I already got a gig, but I think it would be fun to go. But I appreciate you saying that. That makes me feel good. Mostly, I always try. I don't read as much now as I used to, but I used to read a lot more. And I was never good at school, man. Never. I just couldn't. It was the wrong years for me. Mm-hmm. I was so interested in other things. And my wife and I talk about that. Those are the years that they ought to make you work all day. And then about 22, you start asking questions. And that's when I wanted my free education, man.
Absolutely.
I was trying to get away from it. I was trying to talk to girls.
You hear that from so many of your peers. And I think that's almost a universal thing.
Because
you don't appreciate an education until you get out in the big world and find out how important it is.
I find myself taking I'll get my nieces and nephews and they'll get their textbooks and read them and go, God, that was great. That's a science book. You know, like I didn't know that about the clouds. I skipped that day.
And now when you're going to gigs, you're flying through them.
What is that?
Right.
Fascinated by the world finally.
right.
But that makes me feel good. Thanks for saying that.
Tape is rolling. I want to send this song out to Michael Moondog Webb, Wreck of Honor and King of Fraser. A little out of place, a little out of tune, sort of lost in space, racing the moon, climbing the walls of this hurricane, still overall. All I wanted was one chance to let freedom ring. They said I had to get a permit, tags and everything. I never made it through that red tape. I got this paper hat. I got a job working weekdays. You want fries with that? I got nothing to lose. I got nothing to gain. It's like a one-way ticket to cruising that passing lane. I can't complain. talking with my girlfriend. I told her I was stressed. I said I'm going off the deep end. She said give it a rest. We're all waiting in the dugout, wishing we could pitch. How you gonna throw a shutout if all you do is bitch? I got nothing to lose, 'cause there's nothing to gain. It's like a one-way ticket to cruising that passing lane. I can't complain. So now I got a brand new dance. I need one more shot. I just need one last chance. You know I won't get caught. I gotta make my last stand. This time I can't be bought. But then again, on the other hand, how much have you got? I got nothing to lose. I got nothing to gain. It's like a one-way ticket to cruising that passing lane. I can't complain. A little out of place, a little out of tune. We're all lost in space, a race in that moon. Climbing the walls of this hurricane. Still overall, I guess I can't complain. I can't complain, I can't complain.
I want to talk to you about a hallmark of much of your work that's common to precious few America's finest songwriters, and that's humor.
Yeah, yeah.
You are truly a funny guy, and I can't say that about a whole lot of, right. Of songwriters. Have you ever done stand-up comedy?
No, I've been asked to try, and I, you know what's funny though? I've thought about trying it. I don't think I could do it with the pressure. I've always told my manager, well, you know, my managers would not want me to try that, I don't think, because they'd probably lose me to it, but I don't think I could do it with that pressure of it being. That's what I've always told my friends, like, just tell me I have to make them laugh and I won't be able to.
Right.
But since all I'm supposed to do is technically play beer run and a couple other things, then I'll have a few drinks and the thing goes the way it goes. But I always and I've met a lot of friends I get a lot of comedians that come to the show and I love to talk to them. I think they're just as fascinating as other songwriters. And some of them, there was a guy named Mitch Hedberg that I swear to God, I thought there's no difference between this guy and Steve Earle. These are two people that just have a different way of carving out their point. But I've always liked being around those types of people. And I go there's a show called The Bob and Tom Show. And they're like, mm-hmm. They've been comedians for 30 years. And I asked Bob, I said, we were in the Bahamas together not long ago. And I said, do you think if I tried to be a comedian, I could do it? And he said, no. I don't. It's harder than it looks. One thing I've learned from being on shows like that is that guy like me that you grew up with that's a class clown, he can't do it.
I've learned the same thing.
It's hard. It's a hard job. You ever see that Jerry Seinfeld movie? There's a movie where he lets himself be documented working on his jokes, and it's almost like he's working on songs, you know? I got to be around Conan O'Brien a few times where they'll be working out the show, and him and that guy Andy Richter, I sat with them while they wrote the funniest thing I'd ever heard. Neither of them laughed even a little bit.
Who is it that said comedy is not pretty?
It's not pretty. They were so serious. I was like, how can you be having this? And this is as much as they do. They'd be like, that would be very funny. Everybody would laugh if I say that. Yeah, say it just like that. That'll be very hysterical. And I'm like, God, they're at work, you know?
They're
and
at work.
And then that night, boy, they put these same lines that they said in monotone. Mm-hmm. they put this inflection in them. I was like, well, that's a show there. Those guys know what they're doing.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
the only thing I've ever been good, I've always been good at this one little particular grift. I can go into a folk house and play those three. I can get by doing that thing I just did a minute ago.
Right.
That's always anytime I've ever tried to deviate from my one little shtick that Keith Sykes taught me, I've always ended up with a car and a tree.
B double E double R U N, Beer Run. B double E double R U N, Beer Run. All we need is a 10 and a 5 or a car and a key and a sober driver. B double E double R U N, Beer Run. A couple of frat guys from Abilene drove out all night to see Robert Earl Keen at the K-Pig Swine and Soiree dance, wore baseball caps, khaki pants, they wanted cigs, so to save some money, they got one off a hippie that smelled kind of funny. The next thing they knew, they was both really hungry and pretty thirsty too. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. All we need is a 10 and a 5 or a car and a key and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. They found a store with a sign, said their beer was coldest. They sent in Brad, cause he looked the oldest. He got a case of beer and a candy bar. Walked over to where them registers are. Laid his fake ID on the countertop. The clerk looked, he turned, he looked back, he stopped. He said, boy, I ain't calling the cops, but I am keeping this card. The guys took it hard. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. Happy we would be if we only brought a better fake ID on B double E double R U N Beer Run. They met this other old hippie named Sleepy John. He claimed to be the one from the Robert Earl song, so they gave him their cash. He bought them brews. It's a beautiful day out in Santa Cruz. They was feeling so good, should have been a crime. Crowd was cool, the band was prime. They made it back up to their seats just in time to sing with all their friends. The road goes on forever, and the party never ends. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. All we need is a 10 and a 5 or a car key and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. Except B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run.
What songwriters do you admire? You mentioned some earlier that are clever and humorous.
One of my favorite is probably my biggest heroes and influence on the humor. And the reason why I started making up songs like that was John Prine. Yeah. And he still is so funny to me. And one thing I always liked about him, and we've talked about this, is there's this way sometimes where if something really makes you sad, you can find a way to get in there. Like when I started making up songs, the very first reason, as God is my witness, is the same reason I do it now. It makes me feel better about the stuff that's happening to me. And the fact that I get to do it for a living, it's like someone saying, here, we're going to pay you to take this medicine. And so, I learned from him that there's a way, if something really sad happens to you and you're not afraid to approach it with a sense of humor, it's just... it can be so much more healing, if only in that moment when you're at your house by yourself working on your song. But it's so worth it. That feeling to me is so worth it if something's too hard for me to face and life shows me a way to chuckle at it. It makes it fun for me to play that song later. It makes it fun for me to play those songs. In fact, I've found the songs that I make up that I just think are funny, I don't take them out of my house because I know I'm not going to play them over and over. But even like a song as like My Generation that's so funny, there's a rooted place where I felt disenfranchised from my peers and it was killing me. And I found this way to say it, and that has made it so I don't mind playing that song every night. But if it's some little fart joke I just sing to crack up my tour manager for 5 minutes, I find that I don't want to do it again tomorrow. But if there's, even on the funny stuff, if there's an emotional thing in there, it makes me smile every night. And then the other guy that I love that I just met last week is Randy Newman.
Oh.
Yeah.
good. That wasn't on my list. Yeah. I had a couple of other ones down here that are my favorites. But,
who else did you have?
Well, no, wait a minute. Okay. This is about you. Okay. That's a good one that I hadn't thought of.
He's
Randy,
a big idol.
He's brilliant.
I know
and
everything.
He's funny.
Yeah.
He's clever.
Yeah.
And
love
good.
How he gets into characters and voices. I saw him. I was on a plane with him the other day, flying from Ottawa to somewhere to do
that
a festival.
Must have been the fastest flight.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God! And I didn't say nothing to him. And then finally,
oh, you didn't
I got
talk
the courage
to
up at,
oh,
when we were getting our bags.
Oh.
And we were going to the same festival, so we both had drivers coming up with our names on signs. And I said, "Hey, man, I'm Todd Snyder. I didn't want to bother you during the day, but I love you so much." And I said, "I know every word to every song, and I could do lyrics till you were freaked out."
Wow.
And he said, "You know, that would freak me out. Don't do that." He was really nice to me, though. He said he knew who I was and that he said, "My kids listen to you."
Oh, very
and
nice.
Then he said, I don't, because I'm afraid if I like it, it just bums me out when I hear young people that I like. I just wish you kids would stop.
That's funny.
He was cracking me and my tour manager up. He had us go. And then I said, "Well, I'm going to go see Buddy Guy later. Are you going to go?" And he goes, "No, I know those chords." Isn't that great?
Yes.
I adore him, and I really do. I know all the songs. And I'd say him and Prine are probably, on my words, they're the biggest influence I got. And then maybe on the way that I try to act during the show, that may be like a Jerry Jeff and Arlo Guthrie.
Oh, my. Very good.
Those are my two. And then when I was younger, I used to try to act like Joe Ely.
Oh.
You know.
There's a Lone Star legend.
Yeah.
Wow.
But mostly, when I was real young, I used to try to do Jerry Jeff. And then I started trying to stand like Joe Ely. I was 25 when I thought, maybe you should try to stand like you stand when you're just being a normal person. It took
idea.
Me a few years to let go of all my heroes. Yeah. But there was time when, now I just try to be myself. But
you do a great job.
Oh, thanks.
You know, just the other morning, I was hanging around in my house. I had that new book with pictures of Madonna naked. I was checking it out. Just then a friend of mine came through the door. Said she'd never pegged me for a scumbag before. She said she didn't ever want to see me anymore. And I still don't know why. Couple of dicks, but still they made me do
have somehow gravitated towards three of the funniest people in music I know, and that is Keith Sykes, Jimmy Buffett, and John, and you mentioned John
Bryan, and Jimmy, I should have said, he's another one. When I was, before I even knew who those other guys were, when I was a kid, that I guess that was probably the first person I heard that was kind of funny on their record.
Definitely.
You know, because he was in the, he made it out into the suburbs somehow, and those other guys maybe didn't, but I'd heard of him. I found out who Keith was through my Jerry Jeff Walker records, and there was a time, and well, still, I know everybody that writes all his songs, and I'm got my ear perked out for them, and I'd say if anybody taught me, the most I've learned about being on stage is probably from Keith, and Jimmy has taught me a lot, too. He taught me a secret. In fact, he told me a secret about the talking in between songs that I have vowed never to tell anybody, and it's this thing that is the most valuable thing I think anyone ever taught me. Maybe, if you're really talking about, I don't know, because people say they like it when I tell those stories, and it's a fact that there's this one little thing that makes it so that's easy to do, or there's a trick to remember, and I don't want to get too far into it.
No, you know what I mean?
But there's a trick. There's a trick to that, and Jimmy Buffett showed it to me one night.
No, he's an old pro.
Yeah, and I now when I see him, I go, wow, he does it. And then I saw John do this, and I said, John, are you doing what I think you're doing? He goes, oh yeah, that's how you do that. And I said, I'll do it just like that from now on.
During a recent interview, someone pointed out how funny Bob Dylan's lyrics are.
Stones, too, I think.
Well, yeah. Well, and Mick Jagger, good point. But, you know, it's funny. For some reason, Dylan got this mantle hung around him of being, you know, so serious and brooding and stuff like that. And somebody pointed out, reminded me, you know, like how take Subterranean Homesick Blues or something, how funny his lyrics can be.
And oh, my God.
True.
I think he's hysterical. And I always think he was offended. There's a part of music, and this is maybe just my own thing, my own defenses, but I've thought it about Dylan. It seems like there's the person that considers themselves a hyper-intellectual, doesn't want any of that in there. And it kind of felt like when Dylan made his way into those people's presence, they didn't want to talk about that. But I always thought he was very funny, and where I got the idea to do talking blues that were funny was from Dylan records that I heard at Keith's house.
Sure.
And there's a lot, you know, Keith Richards said, I just read an interview where they asked Keith Richards the key to rock and roll, and he said he thought it was humor. I think most of the cats that are older know it, you know. People, I feel sometimes I meet, I've had a couple of young artists come up to me and they say, hey, I have a funny song, and now that's all everybody wants to hear. Should I worry about that? And I say to them, I say, whoever's telling you should be worried about that is, I don't know why they're trying to get in your head, but, you know, if the people are cheering at the end of one of your songs, man, have an extra beer after the show and tell yourself, way to go. And like I said, you know, I don't know, like, you know, there are some people that are, you know, Jim Morrison or whatever. I have some bands that I really like I can think of right now, Sunvolt, where that kid, I say kid, he's my age. Oregonians call each other kid, but that guy really works in that field of sorrow, and I love it when he does it. It's just never been for me, you know.
You've got somebody like a Billy Joe Shaver. I'm told that
he's funny too.
He's
boy.
Hysterical. And I mean, you know, if anybody's had you know, heartbreak in real life, it's Billy Joe.
Yeah.
But the guy is still. He was up here a couple of weeks ago, you know, and he's every other line out of his mouth is colorfully funny.
Yeah. He's a brilliant person to me.
You know,
he's always been a hero to me. You were saying that about education. He got through the eighth grade, and you talk about a writer.
Oh,
that was always something that when I did think about, well, you know, how are you going to be a writer? You never even went to school. I always used to say, well, Billy Joe Shaver didn't go to no school. You know, I sure love him. He's been a good friend to me. He's a hero to me, and he's another one. When I first started, I guess I was living with Kent, and he was his songs are kind of funny, and all the people he was turning me on to were kind of funny, and so I just headed down that road.
Smoking long black Cadillac, the get up on the sidewalk like he owned the whole damn town. I'd hear him talking to some chick through a thick ghost of smoke, through a thicker haze of southern comfort and cold. Say, girl, you're hotter than the hinges hanging off the gates of hell. Don't be afraid to turn to me, baby, for he don't treat you well. And by he meant me. So I laughed and I shook his hand. He laughed a little bit louder as he'd yell up at the band. Play a train song for me one more round. Make them leave my boots on when they lay me into the ground. I am a runaway locomotive out of my one-track mind. And I'm looking for any kind of trouble that I can't find. I got this old black leather jacket, got this pack of Marlboro Reds, I got this stash here in my pocket, I got these thoughts in my own head. The right to run until I've got to walk, until I've got to crawl. This moment that I'm in right now and nothing else at all. I play a train song, pour me one more round. Make them leave my boots on when they lay me into the ground. I am a runaway locomotive out of my one track mind. A little smile across his face. And though I tried with all of my sadness, somehow I just could not weep. For a man who looked to me like he died laughing in his sleep. Singing a train song, dragging on one last round. We made him leave his boots on the day they laid him down. He was a runaway out of his one-track mind. Play a train song, play a train song, play a train song.
At least 11 years ago, you were writing about a couple of subjects that could have been taken from the headlines off of today's 2007 newspaper, and that is immigration and jobs and xenophobia and fear.
Yeah.
How fear is being used to manipulate votes and politics and things like that. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. We didn't have the 9/11. This was a pre-9/11 world.
Right.
So you were like prescient when you were writing these things, and that blows me away.
Oh, that makes me feel good. I remember.
So tell me about writing, for instance, specifically tension and what you were seeing in our world. This was like This was mid-90s.
Yeah. I remember when I started working on that song, I remember specifically I was in Atlanta on my girlfriend's couch watching a movie, and I want to try to remember the name of the movie. But that's what started that whole chain of thinking, was that this movie ended with you know, like it's illegal entry is what it was called. And the bad guy's a genius for 60 minutes, and then the good guy puts a bullet through his head, and that's it. And that put me out, and I just started writing all that poetry. And then I remember thinking, like we were talking about Dylan, like I was going to say, my favorite freaking comedian, Bob Dylan. And I wanted to do a talking blues that got into that. And then that one thought led to the next. And I guess I read the newspaper a lot, and I watch the news a lot, and I just have always have. And then I just sort of regurgitate my opinions about it. And then I feel like, and I always say to the crowd, I feel like it's okay if I share my opinions with you, because I'm a folk singer for starters, and so you should know a little bit about what you came in here for. And I'm also telling you that this rhymes, so I don't necessarily think these things are necessarily correct. But sometimes, like in that song, I feel like it's fun to use the talking blues platform to express what I think is going on sort of politically in the world. And I try to talk about it, and I try to back away from talking literally about it. And sometimes that makes it funner, like using a movie as a reference, or using, you know, when I was a kid, I realized I thought my church was trying to scare me into line. And I thought that they were in cahoots with my government. And I still think that's very much the case, you know. I guess I was just trying to get all that out. There was a guy that used to hang around Cheatham Street Warehouse named Terry Warren, and he had taken, I had heard him take the talking blues and change it a little bit like that. And I was really copying him and Dylan, more him in the way I was playing it. But it was hard to remember writing those things. They just sort of coming out, they were just sort of blasting out at the time. It'd take a few months to work on them. I remember also about that song, it was just a poem, and I was making a commercial for the record, the first record. And they just said, well, we want you to read your poetry on these commercials. And I was reading my poetry, and this friend of mine heard me read that, and he said, "That's you should make some music for all that." And that was Bob Mercer. I still work with Bob Mercer.
Oh, I know that name.
Yeah. He's like a dad to me. That's funny.
You said, I don't hate the people, meaning the immigrants. I don't hate the people that took the jobs. I hate the people that sent the jobs away.
Yeah.
You wrote that 11 years ago.
Yeah.
But that is an extremely sensitive, controversial issue today.
Yeah.
I mean, they're voting on things like that in Congress today.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were talking about that 11 years ago.
And I guess I was just trying to say folk singery crap. I really was. All I ever wanted to be was a folk singer, and it seemed to me like that's what you did. You Woody Guthrie, it seemed like he felt like there was, I don't know if I guess he really thought he was going to help anybody, but it seemed like a noble way to try to do that. And I just always thought it was an honest thing to try to do, be a folk singer. And so I wanted to. And back then, it's funny, now I'm a lot more, I've learned over the years that I really want the songs to be these things that meant something to me. Like, I didn't know at the time I wrote two other songs that week, I can tell you right now, that I don't like to play no more. But that one, I've learned over the years to try to let the ones that don't really, like, back then I just said, I need another song because I'm a folk singer. Now I'm older and I'm like, I don't need another song, man. I got a ton of them. I'm a little more,
I've always thought of it kind of like fishing. You know,
yeah.
You pull out what you got that catch that day, and you throw the little ones back in.
Yeah,
there, right?
That's what I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds to me like you ever see when Fred Sanford dances? I think the music, it's a different kind of music than we've done before. It sounds like Fred Sanford dancing. I always thought Jerry Jeff Walker was just hearing stories and then taking them someplace. Someone tells me a story in San Francisco, I get to be the one to take it to New York. And I can tell it to a lot of people if I make it rhyme.
Hey, hey, my, my, rock and roll will never die. Just hang your hair down in your eyes, you'll make $1 million. Well, I was in this band going nowhere fast. We sent out demos, but everybody passed. So one day we finally took the plunge, moved out to Seattle to play some grunge. Washington State, that is. Space Needle, Eddie Vedder, Mutton Honey.
fast, we wear flannel shirts. We turn our amps up until it hurts. We got bad attitudes, and what's more, when we play, we stare straight down at the floor while we pretty scary. How pensive, how totally alternative. Now to fit in on the Seattle scene, you gotta do something they ain't never seen. So thinking up a gimmick one day, we decided to be the only band that wouldn't play a note under any circumstances. Silence, music's original alternative. Roots grunge. Well, we spread the word through the underground that we were the hottest new thing in town. A record guy came out to see us one day, and just like always, we didn't play, it knocked him out. He said he loved our work. He said he loved our work, but he wasn't sure if he could sell a record with nothing on it. I said, tell him we're from Seattle. He advanced us $2.5 million. Hey, hey, my, my, rock and roll will never die. Hang your hair down in your eyes, you'll make $1 million. Well, they made us do a video, but that wasn't tough because we just filmed ourselves smashing stuff. It's kind of weird because there was no music, but MTV said they'd love to use it. The kids went wild, the kids went nuts. Rolling Stone gave us a 5-star review, said we played with guts. We were scoring chicks, taking drugs, and we got asked to play MTV Unplugged. You should have seen it. We went right out there and refused to do acoustical versions of the electrical songs that we had refused to record in the first place. Then we smashed our shit. Well, we blew them away at the Grammy show by refusing to play and refusing to go. And then just when we thought fame would last forever, along come this band that wasn't even together. Now that's alternative. Hell, that's alternative to alternative. I feel stupid and contagious. Our band got dropped, and that ain't funny, because we're all hooked on drugs, but we're out of money. So the other day I called up the band. I said, boys, I've taken all I can. Shave off your goatees, pack the van. Going back to Athens.